Now we'll get into some of the broadcasting stuff. When did you first start calling into the Don Vogel Show?
1986.
Okay. And was it called the Vogel Show? I mean, was it the Afternoon Saloon back then?
No, I named it the Afternoon Saloon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I named it that.
Okay.
It used to go, Don Vogel, the Don Vogel Show. That's how it would start out. What was that guy's name? We used to do that. Bill Kremlinger or something. Kremlinger. He did the theme song, and Don would come on, and he'd have John McDougal doing news and Bruce Gordon doing sports, and he'd have an engineer, and he'd have a producer, and it was a whole ensemble cast, and Vogel was so great at bouncing off people. It was so wonderful to hear him react to people, and then, of course, to hear them react to him, which was mostly just a laugh track that they would provide. So I was calling during those glory years. Those were actually his best years here in the Twin Cities. Those
really?
Were his best years. Yeah, that crew, McDougal, Gordon, David Elveen, Mitch Berg, those were the big years.
Were they all on-air talent together?
Or was it they had, you know, Vogel? Back then they had more money apparently around here, paid a lot. One guy was an engineer, one guy handled producing, one guy handled news, one guy handled weather. You could have that then. Years later, they pared everything down and kicked all these guys out, said, we can't pay all these people. And that was too bad. But the reason you know those were the glory years is because Vogel got hired from that gig by a big-time station in Chicago, and that's major market right there. So they liked what they heard, and everybody in town liked what they heard listening to Vogel back then. Steve Cannon was, of course, king, but Vogel was prince. And
or the jester.
Yeah, but he was big. He was big. I remember everybody knew Vogel back then.
Okay.
But he got hired in Chicago in 1987, and said goodbye and killed off all his characters and had me into the studio, had me shot, and then went to Chicago, and that was that. Went on with my life. And 5 years later, who returns to the Twin Cities? March of 1991? Vogel. He's back. I couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, there he is. Called him up because I knew him from my days calling in back in the 80s. Called him up, and we hooked up for a few drinks, went out a few times, and he was lamenting that he can't work with anyone anymore. Then they don't give him any people to feed off of. His producer was an intern out of Brown. It was just really lonely in that studio. And, of course, I jumped at that and said, boy, I'll get in there. You can bounce things off me. I was just chomping at the bit to work with the master. And he gave me a shot, and KSTP didn't like it, but they said, if you like it and you think you do a better show, Don, you can have him. We'll give him $20 every time he comes in. So that's how I started here.
And you've mentioned that many times in the past. Was that true, $20 per show?
$20 a show, yeah. That's exactly to the penny what I got.
And how long were you working for $20 a show?
I think a year.
Okay. Do you remember, though, back in those early years in 86 or whatever, do you remember your very first call to Don Vogel and what it was like or what happened?
Yeah, my very first call, Don Vogel was giving away T-shirts and some bumper stickers on his show, and I was driving a delivery van, and my brother, Paul, told me I should listen to Don Vogel, because Paul was also driving a delivery vehicle, and I didn't know anything about talk radio outside of Steve Cannon, and I thought that was just for folks like my pop.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew about FM, and so I spun over to AM, and tuned into this Vogel guy, and I thought, wow, that's interesting. This is for people my age, and this is some pretty good radio. And then when I heard you could call in and get on the air, I thought, well, that's too good to be true. That's too good to pass up. I have to give that a shot, see if you can really get on the air. Well, I was very nervous when I called, and I got on the air, and I didn't know what to say. And I was really shocked that they put me on. I was just frozen. And I think I know what I said. And it makes no sense, and I don't want to explain it because there's no way to explain it, but I just said, T-shirts and bumper stickers! And I hung up. And for some reason, they laughed their ass off at that.
Yeah.
Vogel and McDougal and Gordon. Now, had they said, what an idiot, I would have been so embarrassed. I not only would have never called again, I never would have listened to that show again. But they were laughing, which is probably a product more of just the moment. You know, a lot of times when you laugh on the air, it has to do with what's happened in the last 15 minutes, what's happened on that particular day, just where your mood is at, what sort of tension you're feeling and that you want to release. It had nothing to do with that being funny. It had to do with just something struck them, but because they laughed, they encouraged me. Sure is. Any comic out there, the first time someone laughed at something they said, thought, hey, I'm onto something here.
So if they had just not laughed and carried on with the show, that could have been the end of
that
the,
would have been
the radio
would
broadcasting
have been
career.
Oh, yeah, that would have been it. Wow. And the next day I tried it again, and I said something else stupid because I was too nervous when I got on to stay on long, and I certainly didn't want to have a two-way conversation. That would have been way too much to deal with. So I yelled something else and hung up. And he laughed again, and the third day I did it again, and he said, this is a guy who's been calling lately. We ought to give him a name, like the Phantom Caller or something. He calls up, yells weird things, and hangs up. And I thought, I got a name. I'm a guy. I'm somebody.
Is that how all the Phantom calls went?
No,
was it
just
you talking, or did Don ever interact with the Phantom?
Never. There was never any. The whole deal with the Phantom is you didn't talk to the Phantom.
Okay.
The Phantom said his piece and hung up. Sometimes his piece took 3-4 minutes, but there was no talking to the Phantom, and there was no identifying the Phantom. The Phantom would be Mark one day, Bob the next, Jim the next, Dave the next, and I always used different voices so that they never knew it was going to be me.
Right.
They'd just go to the phone and say, Dave from Fridley, you're on, and it'd be the Phantom all of a sudden appearing. So the element of surprise was very important, and that, I think, added to the humor in terms of them laughing because they never could prepare for it. It would just happen out of the blue.
Okay, so they never saw it coming. All it looked like just
right.
a regular call.
Looked
then
like a regular call on the
screen.
Wouldn't
know until Don picked it up, and all of a sudden there's this guy rambling on and on with his soliloquies. Any idea how many calls you made over the years as the Phantom?
Well, I made a rule. I had to call at least 4 times a week, I told myself, that I needed that kind of regularity. And so at least 4 times a week for, it was only 9 months.
Really?
Before Don left. Yeah, that was 86, and he was gone in 87. So it was only about 9 months of doing that before he left. So 9 months of 4 days a week.
16. Still, it's well over, around 150 calls, maybe,
yeah.
If I'm doing my math right.
And they're
a little more.
They're unfortunately not available at the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting.
But they are available at MichiganMadness.com.
Oh, you have some Phantom calls?
There's a few Phantom calls on there, maybe 10, a dozen.
Wow.
Okay. And so when did you actually start working? When Vogel came back, went to Chicago, came back.
Came back 5 years later. And
you had your talk.
He came in March, and I started with him in June of 1990. What the hell? Wait a minute here. When did I start?
He came back in 92?
When the hell did he come back? 91 or 92? Did I start in 91 or 92? I always say 92, but yeah. Yeah, sure it was. 92.
So
he came in March of 92. I started June of 92.
June what?
I don't know.
So right now we're at about the...
Oh, yeah. It was the early part of the month. Yeah, it was right about now.
And
in fact,
really
we're also
June
right
now.
Around the anniversary of Don's death. I think the anniversary is June 5th. But I started right, let's see, so how many years is that, Mr. Mathematician?
92 to 2005, I'd say 13
so
years.
So I'm starting my 14th year.
Starting your 14th year on the air.
Yeah.
At KSTP. Okay.
Thought of another job I had. I used to do the morning news at KFAI radio.
That was my next question, if you
free.
Had any other prior
Oh, yeah, I did
radio
work. I was a DJ up at St. John's University at their radio station. And then I was doing news at KFAI. I'd get there at 5:30 in the morning. I'd do the 5:30 news, 6, 6:30, 7, 7:30, and 8 o'clock news, and then go home, not make a dime. And what happened was, after a while, I started a mess with the news. I started to change it, which was completely unethical. I mean, that I'm embarrassed, and I apologize to the folks at KFAI. They didn't know, mostly because no one listened. But I would mess with the news, and I would change it, and I would add elements that were impossible. And that became fun. Just doing the new straight wasn't fun, but when I could play with it, embellish it, toy with it, alter it, that was joy. And so I really think maybe that was the start of the current Mishki broadcast.
Yeah,
tweaking the news like that.
Didn't anyone ever call in and say,
"No, I honestly don't think anybody was."
No,
I could make something up, and they wouldn't get a complaint call. That was worrisome. I don't know how many listeners that station has at 5:30 in the morning.
So did management? Did anyone ever say anything to you, or no? You just kept on doing this.
No, just kept doing it, and then
never heard a word
quit
about it
because it was too damn early.
Okay.
I'm not a morning person. I learned that. I tried morning drive here at KSTP. I'm not a morning person.
So the lure of early morning hours and no pay was not enticing enough.
Pay didn't matter. I never did make any money until long after I got here at KSTP. None of the jobs I have ever paid much. I lived in the old NSP power plant on the Mississippi, and I lived in little tiny efficiencies. I always lived cheaply and never made any money, and my friends who made money always would pay when we went out. And ask Mark Moeller, that hasn't changed. Mark has never once in the years we've been together, never once watched me buy him a drink.
Yeah.
And I have never successfully put a greenback across a bar when I've been with Moeller. So I'm a leech.
Still to this day.
To this day. And now when I do try to pay, because, you know, and I am making a little money now. Now when I do try to pay, no, I like the record. You know, the record, the years of me having never bought him anything. I don't even buy him anything on his birthday. And he likes to be able to tell people that, and he doesn't want that destroyed by me buying him a whiskey one day.
So you're going to try and keep that going for
life?
Yeah,
I'm going to try to, as a favor to him, I'm going to try to have him continue to buy me stuff.
That's considerate of you. And I do have one guilty admission to make here. I first started listening.
I don't care. You know, who you like, men, women, that's your business. Derek, let's just get back to the interview.
Okay, but actually it was a man I did like, but it was a broadcaster in the broadcasting sense. I came across Vogel probably in 94.
I was
95.
Gone. I only lasted 17 months with him.
You were gone at that time, and I thought that it was the Afternoon Saloon, which I didn't know you had named, but I love that broadcast, and if this wasn't his good stuff, I can't imagine what it was like back in the mid to late 80s.
The glory.
The mid-80s.
Mid-80s. Well, see, I used to come in, Don and I were working first 2 to 4 and then 4 to 6, and we moved to 4 to 6 when Suchere was hired. So I was working here before Suchere was hired for his full-time slot. And
What did Sush do back then? Just a Saturday morning show?
He wrote a column and did his Saturday show. And I think he also did back then a Monday Sports Talk. Monday Sports Talk and Saturday morning Sports Talk. And then he did his column. And he was happy. And I don't know why he needed more. Now what's the freak working? 6 days a week. I thought for sure when he went 5 days a week, he would quit the Saturday show. Who the hell wants to come in 6 days a week? But they must throw a lot of dough his way. Anyway, when I was working with Don 2 to 4, Rush was working 11 to 2, and Turi Ryder was working 4 to 7. And Turi Ryder was the only woman in the United States holding down an afternoon drive time show.
Really?
Yeah. That was her claim to fame, or the Hubbard's claim to fame. Having her there. And anyway, she got canned, and Don and I moved to that drive time slot. Suchere got hired 2 to 4, and Don and I worked together 17 months, had a classic Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin breakup, a classic Simon and Garfunkel type breakup, classic, what are the other ones? Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig breakup. And you must have tuned in shortly after that.
Yeah, I must have. I only heard Don Vogel. Yep. I never heard the two of you working together, which I'm sad to hear now because I would have loved to hear some of that early stuff.
Yeah, and of course, there was no Derek Larson back then archiving at all.
There wasn't.
Mm-mm.
I listened to Vogel. And also, did you have your show right away after the breakup, the Mishki broadcast?
Don and I split up, and we split up in October, I think, of 93, and yeah, we did. And I started, after a few days, I started working morning drive with Pat Mylan. Mylan and Mishki in the morning. And I got to ride every day
3M.
In a limousine. was the only guy in America. In fact, this is my great claim to fame, and I honestly believe this to be true. I can't prove it, but I defy someone to show me I'm wrong. I'm convinced I was making less money than anyone in the United States who was getting to work every day in a limousine, a stretch limo.
And why were you in a limo? Who was
sending
over
the limo? That's an excellent question, Derek. Crazy as it sounds, they wanted Pat Mylan in the morning so badly. They had hired him in September, long before knowing that I was going to split with Vogel. And he was supposed to be the next big thing in this town, Mylan in the morning.
Okay.
And he was a great negotiator. He'd be one of those guys going, I got other things going. I work at Tunheim Santrisos as a PR guy and making big money. My wife's a model. We're rich. We don't need you, Hubbards. And they kept, you know, trying to entice him. They really wanted him. He used to be a political reporter at Channel 5. And eventually he said something to the effect, I live in Edina, you know, that's a long haul every morning, you know, the cold winter months, long haul over there. Then I got to get there and do a bunch of show prep. And the Hubbard said, we'll give you a limousine. You can do the show prep with a hot cup of coffee, the television on right there in the limousine. Pat said, all right. And so he took him up on it. So I was driving a 62 Ford Galaxy at the time, and I started to work with Mylan. And some days my car wouldn't start. I'd have to 3 in the morning in cold weather. Sometimes it wouldn't start, and got into November, and it really wouldn't. I had problems. And, you know, every day I'd get off work with Mylan and watch him get into his stretch limousine while I got into my Ford Galaxy from 1962. And one day we were arguing on the air about something, and I made some point that, well, someone in your shoes. And he said, no, what do you mean someone in your shoes? There's no difference between you and I. And I said, well, the difference is I don't get a limo ride every day, Pat. And after that, Pat decided that coming down 94, he'd make sure the limo exited on Dale, came down to Grand and picked me up.
Wow.
So every day that limo would be warm, the TV would be on, the coffee would be hot, the newspapers would be laid out. And I would walk out of my little condo on Grand and Dale at 3:30 in the morning into the stretch limo. No one would see me because, of course, the streets were empty and the people were in bed. And I'd go to work, and on the way home, I'd realize Grand Avenue would be bustling at 9:30 in the morning, and no way could I have a stretch limousine pull in front of my house at Grand and Dale and let me out every day. Not only would it be personally embarrassing to me to be living that way, but also people would think I'm doing quite well and would start asking to borrow some money. So I had that stretch limo every day drop me off at the University Club on Summit Avenue, where they're used to seeing stretch limos, and I'd walk home. That was my little plan. Picked up at home because no one was around, dropped off at the University Club.
And how far away was the University Club?
Three block walk. So that was fine. That was perfect. And then they fired Mylan.
How long was Mylan there?
They knocked him out from under me. January 1, he was gone. And in comes the incomparable, irrepressible Jesse Ventura. And they say, want to be his sidekick? And I said, no. They said, why not? I said, because if it's a wild success, it's Jesse's success. And if the show fails miserably, I'll leave with him. Just like Kenny had to leave with Bob Yates when Bob got fired. Just like the Jackal had to leave with Jason Lewis when Jason Lewis left here. So I said, I can't win. So I was out of work for a while. And then a few days later, Ginny calls me up. This would be Ginny Hubbard, now Ginny Morris.
Okay.
And she offered me the nighttime show, 9 to 11. And I said, you got a guy working there, Tom Wyant. Tom had won the show in a contest. The ads on the show were free. You didn't have to pay. If you advertised during the day, you got a free ad at night. The show didn't make a dime. Tom must not have been making much money either, although he was an attorney, so he had a day job. But I said to Ginny, well, Tom's there. That's a little embarrassing for me to take that job. And she said, you're in the radio business, Mishki. Everybody who gets a job because some other guy got fired. Which is true. I mean, we all get work when other people are fired.
Right.
And she fired him.
So did she wait until you had accepted the job and then she told him, you're out of here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know if there were any hard feelings on Tom's part, but I do take solace in the fact that he was an attorney. It wasn't his main job. But I did feel guilty about it.
Right.
I thought that was... I say no, and he keeps his job. I say yes, and he loses his job. So that was that was definitely something that bothered me, but not enough for me to refuse to do it. I wanted some kind of a job, damn it.
Have you spoken with him since?
No, but I've heard from people that he was bummed out at first, but that I think it was later on when I was real established, and he said something to the effect, I think, that he was never going to be able to devote that kind of time to the show. You know, the hours I put in prep for the show, I couldn't have another job. And I think that he was doing it sort of as a lark. And the direction the show ended up going, and I think ultimately would have gone anyway, is more of a serious career type show where you gotta, you know, you can't do other jobs. You gotta really focus on, and sure enough, the show did become a show that actually made money, and you did start seeing people actually have to pay for ads. And Tom was probably making $25 a show or something like that. I mean, it was just this side of college radio.
I didn't want to say anything, but when I drove in here tonight, I saw some guy in rags yelling and screaming, "I want that show back from Mishki." And he kept repeating it over and over.
"I want something else from Mishki." See, it's not about revenge or tears. I've waited by that studio for years. How's the poem go? I don't know.
But
Tommy's probably doing well right now as an attorney in town. He's probably getting someone off of DWI right now as I speak.
Okay. Backtracking a little, what was it, or can you say exactly, that went wrong between you and Vogel that the split happened?
When two creative individuals work together, it is more uncommon for them to get along than not to. Abbott and Costello didn't like each other. Martin and Lewis, you know, big clashes. There were clashes with almost every, you know, Simon and Garfunkel. You can just take any. Heinz and Berglund, Knapp and Donuts. Big clashes. Ruth Kozlak and Steve Cannon. It's just a recipe for disaster. I keep telling Ron Rosenbaum, "Sure, you two are friends now, but see how long it lasts," Ron and Mark. And, you know, Don knew it. He was an older man than I was when we started. He was a wiser man than I was. And he said, "If this ends up ruining our friendship, it will not have been worth it." And, of course, I say at the time, "Ruining our friendship? What the hell are you talking about, Don? How could it possibly do that?" Naive me, all of 29. But Don knew, and it did. And it was mostly clashes of style. I was a guy who liked to prep. He was a guy who said, "Sit down and have fun." That's how I named it, The Afternoon Saloon. Vogel said to me, "Just sit down and have fun. It's like a couple of guys sitting at a bar." And I said, "Oh, okay." So the next day I showed up, I said, "Well, I'm here for my afternoon saloon." And he said, "That's a good one. We'll call it that." And that's how the name came. And but that's how he wanted me to look at it. See, show up at 4, not at 5 to 4, not at 10 to 4, not a quarter to 4, not at 1 in the afternoon when you really could do some show prep. Just show up at 4, we'll wing it. And to be perfectly honest, there was pressure from management on me to get him to change in certain ways. And that was unfair and unfortunate because they should have gone to him. But management is often afraid of talk hosts and goes through producers because talk hosts are temperamental. Talk hosts are nuts. And so they go through producers and try to push the producers to get the talent to do this or that. And that caused some strain, too, because I was working for management and I really couldn't tell them to go screw themselves. And at the same time, Vogel had hired me. So I was really caught between a rock and a hard place. And that was unfortunate. And there were so many times when he and I were doing things that I thought, man, if we just talked about this for 20 minutes before the show, this bit would have been better, that better. But we were the wing it crew. And a lot of guys would have said, "Boy, why push it? Why not enjoy a good thing and come in at 4? Hell with working anymore." But see, my name was associated with that show. And I went home every day in a town where people had heard that show. And I just wanted it to be better. Okay. And he was a great guy and was consistent and just said, you know, he had very little ego in terms of, he didn't care if I became the funny guy on a given day, all the better. But he just pushed that just relax, don't worry about the show, have fun. And that was just not my style. It was for a while, you know, for 6-8 months I was that way, but then I just saw possibilities.
Okay.
And management saw possibilities.
So it really boiled down to just a clash of styles in the end.
Clash of styles, yeah. And also there was some bitterness because Don and I had been buddies before we got into radio. And then, you know, when you work with a guy every single day, you know, you're less likely to call him up Friday night and go out. You've just been with him for 5 days. Whereas before I wasn't working with him and we would go out.
Right.
And then the other thing was during this time I got married and had a kid. So that really changed my availability. And there was some resentment on his part at my having less time for him because he was living like an 18-year-old. He was still a wild man.
Don was married. Did he have any kids?
He did have a daughter from another marriage who was grown when okay. I knew him. So he was married to Janet and did not have children. And they were just wild people. They were just teenagers. They just loved to drink and joke and
love life and live it to the fullest.
Yeah, but Don also had a hard life. And, you know, he didn't have a lot of friends. And so when he found one, he hung on tightly and maybe too tightly. I remember one time I'd known him maybe 2.5 months and he called me his best friend. And I thought, wow, you know, I meanwhile have guys who I've known since I was 7 years old who are my buddies who I'm not prepared to call my best friend because there's another guy I've known since I was three. And, I mean, in St. Paul, you know, people for years and years, and you grow up and you have all these buddies. And I thought, I just met Don, and I'm his best buddy. What, he's 40-some years old. What's been happening in his life that's the case? And, of course, he had a rough life. He was blind from birth. He was the son of an alcoholic father and a mother who was insane, literally, I mean, certifiably. And no brothers and sisters to console him, to help him figure out his insane parents. And it's amazing he got as far as he did. When you grow up that way, you know, you can be so dysfunctional. And to his credit, he was very functional. But I think he brought his own baggage to the table, and I brought mine. And mine was I was young and stupid. And you know, he taught me a lot. He taught me. One of the great things he taught me was to admit you're wrong. He was a master at understanding what happens when you admit you're wrong, when you are humble enough to not have to be right all the time, which was an extraordinary gift to give me. And sometimes when he would do something and then feel it was wrong, he'd show up with a box of cigars for me. And at that point, I was one of those guys who thought if you're wrong, you're bad. So don't ever be wrong, or certainly don't admit you're wrong. And part of me would never believe I was wrong. And I watched that, and he helped change me in that area, which was, I mean, people do that for you when you grow up. When you mature, there are certain people who play roles like that and teach you how to be a more well-rounded human being. And I was not when I met him. And that breakup was as much my fault as his and possibly more my fault. And at the time, I would have blamed it all on him.
Okay.
And it took me a while to realize that was not true. And a lot of that realization came from just that time spent with him and what I learned from him. Now, that's on a personal level. On a professional level, he taught me many things. I could never describe all the things he taught me about radio. I could never catalog all the many influences. The ways my show ultimately connected with threads back to Don and the way he taught me. Not by, you know, saying I'm going to teach you, but just by doing and me
experience.
I just watched him. You know, I could just stare at him. He was blind. He couldn't see I was staring at him. So during the show, I could just sit back and sometimes just marvel at him, just sit back and study him, which was a great thing. He was a great mentor, and his wife was great, and I did go out with her after he died. We went out to a bar, and I told her that I hadn't been able to admit my role in the breakup, and now I can, and I was able to tell her that, and you know, tell her how much he had meant to me. And I also was able, before he died, to have some conversations with him that were sort of the beginnings of the friendship, of not the friendship, but the beginnings of putting the bitterness behind and putting the past behind. And a sign that was working was when, before he died, he had an opportunity to pick a fill-in and picked me to do some fill-in, which I thought was an extraordinary gesture. Very few men would have been able to do that.
You were filling in on the afternoon saloon,
yeah,
towards the end?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And that's knowing that after hearing this story is all you need to know about Don Vogel, to know what a gentleman he was. And then, you know, we never went out again. You know, we never went and had drinks again. I mean, it was never, I don't know, wasn't going to be that kind of a relationship again, but it at least didn't have to be. I think had he lived, we were on a track to get back together again.
Okay.
As friends, but he didn't live. And that was always sad, was then you wonder what would have happened to he and I had he had more time. But he used to tell me, I don't want to see 50. And he died a month before he turned 50. He really dreaded getting old, really dreaded getting old. You know, I don't think he wanted to die at the end. I know he didn't want to die. But, I mean, he had a fear of getting old, and he saw himself as a teenager, and the idea of 50 just really bothered him. And he didn't see it.
As you mentioned, he passed away almost 10 years ago to the date right now. Do you ever see Janet Vogel anymore? Or?
No, I know she remarried.
Okay. I do hear her call in periodically to the broadcast. It's been a while.
Yeah, and she was living in Highland, and I don't know if she still is.
Okay.
She did remarry. She's a great woman, funny, witty. She loved him dearly and was a real loyal friend to him to the end. And he was very, very lucky to have her. She was blind as well from birth.
Okay. And what did he... Oh, she. I didn't know that. She was blind from birth herself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. What was I going to ask here? Do you remember what it was like when, and what did Don actually pass away from? Was it cancer?
Liver cancer.
Yeah. I remember as a listener, I used to listen to the Afternoon Saloon quite a bit. I was working in afternoons. I would have my headphones on, always listen to the saloon. And I remember he wasn't on. At times he'd be gone for a while, then he'd be back on the air for a bit. And you knew something was up or that he was having some kind of troubles. Yeah. But then all of a sudden, out of the blue, it's announced, you know, Don Vogel's passed away.
Yeah, so you guys couldn't see him. If you were here and could see him, you would have seen him withering away, him shrinking before our eyes, him growing gaunt and weak and thin. But you just heard the voice, so you didn't know, and he didn't talk about it.
No.
But in January, we all knew, and in June, he was gone, which is about the run when you have liver cancer. Although, if I knew now... if I knew back then what I know now about cancer, I would have devoted my energies to saving his life.
Right. I've heard a lot of your shows with Lorraine Day. And...
I believe with what I know now, he would not have had to die.
Really?
Yeah. I'm convinced he would have lived.
Well, that's too bad. It happened then. And again, as I'd said before, I was a big fan of Vogel's, and I just heard him during that last year, perhaps two. And at the time, I was aware of another show called the Mischke Broadcast that aired in the evenings.
The Wednesday night show.
The Wednesday night show. It was only on Wednesdays? No.
Oh, I forgot. You just made me think of that. When I was working with Don after a while, they gave me a show every Wednesday night, 7 to 9.
Oh, really?
The Wednesday night radio show. I interrupted Bruce Willis, his syndicated financial advice show, and did a 7 to 9 show every Wednesday night.
Are you kidding?
And,
How long did that run?
I was doing that.
I've never heard you speak of that before.
Yeah, I always forget about it.
Did you call it the Mischke Broadcast, or was it?
Uh-uh, I called it the Wednesday Night Radio Show. And I don't know, it was 7 to 9, and I don't know how long I did it. I don't remember. 1 hour was often a musical guest. I had Willie Murphy in there one time, Spider John Kerner, playing music live and talking. All sorts of different musicians from around town. Remember, I had Tina from Tina and the B-Side Movement on.
Okay.
She was playing guitar and singing, and I just loved her, still do. And Don listened, and the next day he just ripped her on the air, said she was a lousy singer and all this stuff, and I was horribly embarrassed. And
yes,
somebody got word to her, and she tuned in and heard it, and God, it was a bad day. That was a bad day. But in classic Vogel fashion, the next day shows up with a box of 20 Agio Senorita cigars, hands them to me, and said I was wrong. It was your show. I had no right to, you know, make fun of it like that, make fun of a guest. That was unprofessional. And so that was the great thing about him.
Wow.